Lincoln, Disk 11.
Lincoln had trouble defining his own position. A practical man, he knew, as he'd remarked in his eulogy of Henry Clay, that in America, the man who is of neither party is not, cannot be of any consequence. But it wasn't clear what party he should choose. When his old friend Joshua F. Speed, with whom he now differed politically, inquired where he now stood, he replied, "That's a disputed point. I think I'm a Whig, but others say there are no Whigs, and I'm an abolitionist." But, he went on to explain, he resented efforts to un-Whig him, since he was doing no more than oppose the extension of slavery, which had long been the position of most northern Whigs. Certainly, he explained to Speed, he was not a know-nothing. How could I be? How could anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? The United States began with the declaration that all men are created equal. It now was practically read as all men are created equal except Negroes. And if the know-nothings gained control, it would read, all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. When things came to this pass, he told Speed, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty. To Russia, for instance, where despotism can be taken pure and without the base alloy of hypocrisy. By the end of 1855, he found it easier to choose his political course. The Whig Party was no longer a viable political organization. The abolitionist Republican Party of Codding and Lovejoy was too extreme to attract a wide following. The nativist movement had crested as the defeat of a statewide prohibition referendum, sponsored by the Know-Nothings and the temperance organizations, demonstrated. What was now needed in Illinois was what had already taken place in many other northern states. A fusion of all the opponents to the extension of slavery in a new political party. Lincoln was ready to take the lead. In January 1856, when Paul Selby of the Jacksonville Morgan Journal proposed a conference of anti-Nebraska editors to plan for the next presidential election, Lincoln endorsed his idea. And when the editors met at Decatur on February 22nd, he was the sole non-journalist in attendance. With his guidance, the group drafted a conservative declaration that called for restoration of the Missouri Compromise, upheld the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act, and pledged non-interference with slavery in the states where it already existed. To appease the more radical anti-slavery element, the resolutions also affirmed the basic free soil doctrine, which Salmon P. Chase and Charles Sumner had most forcibly enunciated, that the United States was founded on the principle that freedom was national and slavery exceptional. To win foreign-born voters, the platform advocated religious toleration and opposed any changes in the naturalization laws. And to attract the know-nothings, it denounced attacks on the common school system, meaning Catholic efforts to secure aid for parochial schools. Still avoiding the name Republican, the conference called for a state fusion convention to be held at Bloomington on May 29th. On the night the conference adjourned, the editors attended a banquet where Lincoln played a conspicuous role. When one speaker suggested that he ought to be the candidate of the new party for governor, he emphatically refused, stating that an anti-Nebraska Democrat would be more available for that post. But in response to a toast praising him as the warm and consistent friend of Illinois and our next candidate for the U.S. Senate, he rose after prolonged applause and said, "The latter part of that sentiment I am in favor of," pointing out that he felt a little out of place at this gathering, where he was the only non-editor. He capitalized on his odd appearance by saying that he felt like the ugly man riding through a wood who met a woman, also on horseback, who stopped and said, "Well, for land's sake, you're the homeliest man I ever saw." "Yes, madam, but I can't help it," he replied. "No, I suppose not," she remarked. "But you might stay at home." Having thus disarmed criticism, he went on to announce his hearty concurrence in the resolutions adopted by the convention and his willingness to buckle on his armor for the coming fight with the Democrats. Despite Lincoln's very active role at the Decatur gathering, some of his more conservative friends were unaware he was so fully committed to the new political movement. On May 10th, Herndon, who'd been named a member of the Anti-Nebraska State Committee at the editors' meeting, published a call for a meeting of Sangamon County citizens opposed to the Kansas-Nebraska Act to select delegates to the Bloomington Convention. Though Lincoln was out of the office, attending court in Pekin, Herndon signed both his name and Lincoln's. Dismayed at this evidence of radicalism, John Todd Stewart rushed into the Lincoln and Herndon office to ask whether Lincoln had actually signed the call. Herndon admitted his responsibility. "Then you've ruined him," muttered Stewart. But Herndon knew he was doing just what his partner wanted, just what the Decatur Convention had expected him to do. To placate Stewart, he wired Lincoln that the announcement was causing a stir among conservative Whigs. And his partner promptly responded, "All right, go ahead. We'll meet you, radicals and all." Elected a delegate to the Bloomington Convention, Lincoln was committed to the new anti-Nebraska party, but was nevertheless nervous about the outlook. In view of the failure of several previous attempts to organize a statewide anti-slavery party, he had every reason to worry that leading politicians might not attend, and that southern Illinois, where Douglas was so strong, might send no representatives. Arriving in Bloomington early, he had time on his hands and, restless, left David Davis's mansion, where he was staying, to prowl the streets of the little city. To help pass the minutes, he stopped in a small jewelry store, where he bought his first pair of spectacles for 37.5 cents. He kinder needed them, he told Henry C. Whitney, who accompanied him, because he was now 47 years old. Not until he met the late train from Chicago and found it filled with delegates to the convention was he satisfied that the political decision he'd made was a wise one. On May 29th, about 270 delegates assembled in Major's Hall to organize the Illinois Republican Party. All shades of opinion were represented, conservative Whigs like Lincoln, anti-Nebraska Democrats like Norman Judd, know-nothings like newly elected Representative Jesse O. Norton, Germans like Adolph Mayer, and abolitionists like Lovejoy. after conferring with about 20 influential politicians representing all shades of opinion, Orville Browning, the conservative Quincy lawyer, constructed a platform on which all could stand. To placate an estimated 20,000 German voters, it included a pledge to proscribe no one on account of religious opinions or in consequence of place of birth, a promise so vague that it didn't alienate the know-nothings. On slavery questions, the platform ignored abolitionist demands and offered a mild declaration that Congress had the power and the duty to exclude slavery from the national territories. The slate of officers nominated was carefully balanced. William H. Bissell, an anti-Nebraska Democrat who was also a hero of the Mexican War, was the candidate for governor. The German leader, Francis A. Huffman, was nominated for lieutenant governor, and three other offices went to know-nothings who were former Whigs. The delegates recognized Lincoln's role in creating the new party by calling him to the platform to make the last major speech before adjournment. Obviously delighted that the proceedings had gone so smoothly, and undoubtedly relieved that at last his break with the Whig Party was public and irrevocable, he gave what was universally acclaimed as the best speech of his life. Because he spoke extemporaneously, there was no reliable record of what he said. Even Herndon, who usually took notes when his partner spoke, gave up after about 15 minutes and, as he said, threw pen and paper away and lived only in the inspiration of the hour. Only the Alton Weekly Courier, in a brief report, gave the highlights of this major address. After enumerating the pressing reasons of the present movement, Lincoln identified slavery as the cause of the nation's problems. Mistaking the idiosyncratic George Fitzhugh as a representative thinker, he claimed that Southerners were more and more arguing not merely that slavery was a positive good for blacks, but that it should be extended to white laborers as well. Quite erroneously, he claimed that because of Southern pressure, Northern Democrats like Douglas, who'd once advocated the individual rights of man, were beginning to accept this argument. Such was the progress of the national democracy. To oppose this heresy, Lincoln urged a union of all who opposed the expansion of slavery, and again he pledged that he was ready to fuse with anyone who would unite with him to oppose slave power. If the united opposition of the North caused Southerners to raise the bugbear of disunion, they should be told bluntly, the Union must be preserved in the purity of its principles as well as in the integrity of its territorial parts. Firmly, he made Daniel Webster's thundering reply to the South Carolina nullifiers of the motto of the Republican Party: Liberty and Union, now and forever, one and inseparable. His speech was full of fire and energy and force, Herndon recalled. It was logic, it was pathos, it was enthusiasm, it was justice, equity, truth, and right, set ablaze by the divine fires of a soul maddened by the wrong. It was hard, heavy, knotty, gnarly, backed with wrath. To his partner, Lincoln seemed 7 feet tall that day. Lincoln recognized that the Republican Party faced formidable problems in the 1856 presidential contest. Not only was it a new and imperfectly articulated organization, but it had powerful competition. Shrewdly, the Democrats passed over the controversial Douglas and nominated James Buchanan, the former Secretary of State, who had a distinguished career of public service and the inestimable blessing of having been out of the country as minister to Great Britain during the controversy over the Kansas-Nebraska Act. The nativists, now calling themselves the American Party, nominated ex-President Millard Fillmore, whose highly respectable Whig antecedents made him attractive to conservatives of all persuasions. Even Mary Lincoln, usually wholly committed to her husband's political views, confessed that her weak woman's heart compelled her to favor Fillmore, who understood the necessity of keeping foreigners within bounds. To counter the appeal of these two conservative candidates, Lincoln thought it important for the Republican Party, holding its first national convention in Philadelphia on June 17th to 19th, to recognize that 9/10 of the anti-Nebraska voters had formerly been Whigs. He wrote Trumbull, who attended the convention at his urging, that the nomination of Supreme Court Justice John McLean of Ohio would save every Whig except such as have already gone over hook and line to the Democrats. But he carefully explained that he was not inflexible in his choice. "I'm in," he pledged, "and shall go for anyone nominated unless he be platformed expressly or impliedly on some ground which I may think wrong." The Philadelphia Convention didn't follow his advice, nor did it nominate either of the most conspicuous leaders in the Republican movement, William H. Seward of New York or Salmon P. Chase of Ohio. Instead, it chose the flamboyant, highly popular John C. Fremont, widely known as the Pathmarker of the West because of his explorations of the Rocky Mountains. But when it came to selecting a vice presidential nominee, the delegates did look to former Whigs. The most popular candidate was William L. Dayton, a former senator from New Jersey. Unhappy that the new party was failing to recognize the importance of the Northwest, Illinois delegates caucused, and Nathaniel G. Wilcox proposed that they present Lincoln's name to the convention. Trumbull, who was not a delegate but attended the caucus, agreed that Lincoln was a very good man, and all the other members backed Lincoln's candidacy. All through the evening, they worked to secure support in other delegations, convincing the Indiana members that the nomination of Dayton would do great injustice to the western states. On June 19th, the Illinois delegation arranged to have John Allison of Pennsylvania put Lincoln's name in nomination as the Prince of Good Fellows and an Old Line Whig. Then, Illinois delegate William B. Archer seconded the nomination, saying that he'd known Lincoln for 30 years and had always found him as pure a patriot as ever lived. Anti-Nebraska Democrat John M. Palmer, who had been instrumental in preventing Lincoln's election to the Senate in 1855, added his endorsement, announcing, "We in Illinois can lick Buchanan anyway, but I think we can do it a little easier if we have Lincoln on the ticket with John C. Fremont." But the Illinois movement got underway too late, after most of the delegates were already committed to other candidates. In an informal ballot for vice presidential nominee, Dayton received 253 votes to Lincoln's 110. Lincoln was, of course, flattered by the support he received, which was evidence that he was becoming nationally known as a leader of the new party. But he pretended indifference. On the circuit in Urbana, when Davis and Whitney brought him the news, he said with charming false modesty, "I reckon that ain't me. There's another great man in Massachusetts named Lincoln, and I reckon it's him." The nomination of Fremont didn't discourage Lincoln. As he wrote Trumbull, in a carefully chosen double negative, he was not without high hopes for the state, though Illinois Republicans would have had an easier time had McLean been nominated. From the start of the campaign, he made it his mission to win over Fillmore's supporters to the Republican cause. Most of these were, as a man in Clinton wrote him, still tender old-time Whigs, partly with and partly not with us. And they looked to Lincoln for leadership. "In you, they do place more confidence than in any other man," his correspondent continued. "Others may make fine speeches, but it wouldn't be Lincoln said so in his speech." Responding to the need, Lincoln entered the campaign wholeheartedly and, as he remembered, made more than 50 speeches in behalf of the Republican ticket. Most of them were delivered in the central and southern parts of the state, where Fillmore was strong. And there, Republican editors, attempting to appeal to the southern-born voters, stressed that Lincoln was a Kentuckian, a southerner with eloquence that would bear a comparison with Henry Clay's. Few of Lincoln's 1856 campaign speeches were preserved, or were worth preserving. In them, he only occasionally praised Fremont as our young, gallant, and world-renowned commander, or attacked Buchanan and his gang. He made few attempts to excite his audiences with tales of recent atrocities against free state men in Kansas. He didn't mention the quasi-war raging between the pro-slavery Lecompton regime and the free state Topeka government in the territory, and said nothing about the sack of Lawrence by pro-Southern ruffians on May 21st. Nor did he refer to the attack that South Carolina Representative Preston S. Brooks made the following day upon Charles Sumner in the Senate chamber because of his anti-slavery speeches. Instead, Lincoln offered low-key, reasonable arguments to persuade American voters opposed to the expansion of slavery not to waste their votes on Fillmore, who had no chance of winning. In private letters to old Whig friends, Lincoln made the same argument, stressing that a vote for Fillmore was really a vote for Buchanan. "This," he told them, "is as plain as the adding up of the weights of three small hogs." Because he had no secretarial assistants and wanted to reach a larger number of his former political associates, Lincoln had lithographed a form letter marked "Confidential," expressing these views. Filling in the date and salutation by hand, he sent out several dozen of these until one fell into the hands of a Democratic editor who exposed them as form letters. What effect Lincoln had on the outcome of the 1856 election in Illinois was hard for him or anybody else to determine. In Republican newspapers, his speeches were invariably praised as unanswerable, showing great eloquence and power. Democratic papers described his speeches as prosy and dull in the extreme. He himself was under no illusions about the impact of his campaigning, though he was pleased when local Republican leaders said they were tolerably well satisfied with his work. In the end, the canvass verified the prediction Lincoln had made at the start. "With the Fremont and Fillmore men united here in Illinois, we have Mr. Buchanan in the hollow of our hand, but with us divided, he has us." The anti-slavery vote was split, And in November, Buchanan carried Illinois and won the election. When Lincoln looked back on the events of the past 2 years, he had to recognize that he'd received some severe rebuffs. He'd been defeated in his quest for a Senate seat. He'd been snubbed by Eastern lawyers in the McCormick Reaper case. And he'd been passed over for the first Republican vice presidential nomination. On the other side of the ledger, he could enter the solid distinction he'd earned in the campaign against the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the respect that was due him as the principal architect of the Republican Party in Illinois, and the admiration he received as a powerful orator for the free soil cause. After 1856, he found no further occasion to lament to Herndon about his future, or to grieve that he'd done nothing to make his country better. Chapter 8. A House Divided. After the 1856 elections, Lincoln tried to maintain a low political profile. He declined most invitations to speak with the explanation, "Having devoted the most of last year to politics, it's a necessity with me to devote this to my private affairs." He turned to his law practice with great assiduity, and 1857 became the busiest and most profitable year of his professional life. But he had no idea of giving up politics, and he worked, mostly behind the scenes, to maintain and perfect the Republican organization so that it could mount an effective challenge to the re-election of Stephen A. Douglas in 1858. Two weeks after the 1856 presidential election, the fall term of the Sangamon County Circuit Court opened, and Lincoln and Herndon had 5 cases on the first day, 10 on the second. Thereafter, the partners appeared in court day after day, mostly in suits of a routine sort. In addition to his usual work in the circuit courts, Lincoln, in 1857, argued cases more and more frequently in the United States courts, both in Springfield and in Chicago. Often these suits involved greater issues and brought larger fees than trials in the local courts. For example, the trial of the Effie Afton case, which involved the rights of steamship companies as against those of the railroads, kept him in Chicago for most of September. Lincoln devoted a good deal of time during the summer to collecting from the Illinois Central Railroad for his services in the McLean County tax case. He was obliged to sue for his fee, and when the local railroad officials failed to pay it, he went to New York, probably in the hope of collecting it at the company headquarters. Mary accompanied him on what became more of a vacation than a business trip, for the Illinois Central officials were not forthcoming, and the Lincolns spent some time, as Mary said, most pleasantly in traveling east, visiting Niagara and Canada. On their return, Lincoln decided not to wait longer and secured a court order against the railroad's property. With that, the Illinois Central paid up. And just in time, for a month later, the panic of 1857 struck, and the road went into bankruptcy. This was perhaps the happiest time of Mary Lincoln's life. Her marriage to one of the leading public figures in Illinois satisfied her need for status, and her husband's more than respectable income from his law practice soothed her chronic anxiety over financial insecurity. He was now well enough off to take his half of the Illinois Central fee. Herndon received the other half out of the bank and lend it to Chicago attorney N.B. Judd, who was speculating in Iowa lands. Not needing the income immediately, Lincoln allowed the interest to accumulate, so that Judd's note was worth $5,400 when it was redeemed. Because the Lincolns were now moderately well-to-do, Mary Lincoln could turn to expanding and renovating the mean little cottage in which she'd lived uncomplainingly for 13 years. By the mid-1850s, it was bursting at the seams, housing husband, wife, 3 sons, and at times a live-in maid. Anyway, it wasn't a residence becoming a prominent public man. Mary probably took the lead in the renovation, and she may have been able to pay for it with her own money, since in the fall of 1854, she received $1,200 for the 80 acres of Sangamon County farmland that her father had given to her 10 years earlier. By April 1856, the contractors, Hannon and Ragsdale, were at work, and Springfield was buzzing about the changes that the Lincolns were making. "Mr. Lincoln has commenced raising his back building 2 stories high," Mrs. John Todd Stewart reported to her daughter. "I think they'll have room enough before they're done." And she added, a bit maliciously, "particularly as Mary seldom ever uses what she has." The construction was completed while Lincoln was away on the circuit, and he returned to find the cottage transformed into a handsome 2-story Greek Revival house, tastefully painted chocolate brown with dark green shutters. Pretending bewilderment, he sauntered up to a neighbor. "Stranger, do you know where Lincoln lives?" he asked. "He used to live here." As so often happened, his humor miscarried, and it was seriously reported that Mary Lincoln had remodeled the house without her husband's knowledge or consent. Of course he'd known about the remodeling, but he did complain to his wife about the cost of the project. Thereafter, she developed the bad habit of concealing her expenditures from her husband. Adding a full second story to the house at least doubled the Lincolns' living space. The entrance to the house remained the same, but to the right of the front corridor there now was a large sitting room, a comfortable place where the parents could read and the children could play. A front parlor to the left of the corridor served as a formal room for receiving guests. It was connected by double sliding doors with a back parlor that was Lincoln's library and study. In a more pretentious household, the 2 rooms would have been identically furnished as a double parlor, but the Lincolns kept them as 2 separate rooms, which could be opened into 1 on the rare occasions of a large party. On the 2nd floor, Mr. and Mrs. Lincoln now had separate but connecting bedrooms, which were large and comfortable. This wasn't a signal that intimacy or sexual relations between husband and wife had ended. It was the arrangement highly recommended for well-to-do couples by fashionable interior decorators. Separate bedrooms also meant that Mary was less frequently disturbed by her husband's insomnia and nightmares. Robert now had his own room on this floor, and Willie and Tad shared 1 adjacent to it. There was a handsome guest room, and at the rear, a small room for a maid. The remodeled Lincoln house wasn't a mansion like the Edwardses, nor did it rival the very expensive home that Governor Matteson had just built, but it was one of the best in Springfield. In furnishing the house, Mary Lincoln chose wall-to-wall carpets for the parlors in the sitting room, selecting a dark floral pattern that had recently come in style. The parlors had light-patterned wallpaper, but for the sitting room and the bedrooms, she picked dark, boldly figured paper, which was then popular. The heavy, swagged draperies which hung from ceiling to floor she economically had made of cotton damask rather than silk. The rooms were furnished comfortably and unpretentiously, in a variety of styles, and the house was remarkably uncluttered. An air of quiet refinement pervaded the place, a visitor reported. You would have known instantly that she who presided over that modest household was a true type of American lady. That was precisely the impression that Mary Lincoln wanted it to convey. For the house on 8th and Jackson Streets was the center of her world. Finally, she felt comfortable. Her children were now old enough not to require constant supervision, though the younger boys were still much in evidence and, as Mary complained, were disposed to be noisy. Robert, after 1854, was away most days, attending what was grandly called the Illinois State University, really a local preparatory school, so inadequate that in 1859 he failed all the entrance examinations when he tried to enter Harvard College, and had to spend a year at the Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire. Mary, for the first time since her marriage, had time to read and to write long, gossipy letters to her friends and relatives. She also now felt able to entertain properly. Though her dining room was still small, she could give dinner parties for 6 or 8, and guests like Isaac N. Arnold of Chicago long remembered her excellent cooking and her table loaded with venison, wild turkeys, prairie chickens, quails, and other game. But she preferred to give larger buffet suppers, like the very handsome and agreeable entertainment she offered in February 1857. Just possibly an unannounced party for her husband's 48th birthday. No fewer than 500 guests were invited, and it wasn't clear how she expected to squeeze all those people in. Fortunately, a heavy rainstorm and a conflicting engagement kept many of them away. Even so, about 300 had a chance to see her newly expanded and redecorated home. Weary but proud when the affair was over, she wrote her favorite sister in Kentucky, "You'll think we've enlarged our borders since you were here." In part, the Lincolns' hospitality was designed to maintain his network of political friends and acquaintances, because public office was never far from his mind. He wasn't dispirited by the outcome of the 1856 elections. After all, the Republicans had succeeded in electing William H. Bissell as governor. On the national scene, James Buchanan was chosen president only because the opposition vote was split between Fremont and Fillmore, who together had a majority of 400,000. If, he told a gathering of Chicago Republicans in December 1856, these factions could let past differences as nothing be, and could agree that the equality of men was the central idea in our political public opinion, they'd surely carry the next election. A decision handed down by the United States Supreme Court on March 6, 1857, 2 days after Buchanan's inauguration, made the need for a Republican victory both more necessary and more likely. The ruling concerned the fate of Dred Scott, a Missouri slave who had been taken by his owner, an army surgeon, first to Rock Island, Illinois, a state where slavery was prohibited by the Northwest Ordinance, and by its own constitution, and subsequently to Fort Snelling in Minnesota Territory, from which slavery had been excluded by the Missouri Compromise. After returning with Scott to Missouri, his master died. Scott sued for his freedom on the ground that he'd been resident first of a free state and then of a free territory. The case finally reached the Supreme Court. Speaking for a majority of the justices, Chief Justice Roger B. Taney ruled that Scott was not entitled to sue because, as a Negro, he was not a citizen of the United States. At the time the nation was created, Taney pronounced, blacks were considered so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. And the Founding Fathers hadn't included them in either the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. The Chief Justice held further that residents in a free territory did not entitle Scott to freedom, since all congressional enactments that excluded slavery from the national territories, including specifically the Missouri Compromise, were not warranted by the Constitution and were, therefore, void. Anti-slavery spokesmen, like Horace Greeley of the New York Tribune, exploded in anger, denouncing the court's decision as deserving no more respect than if made by a majority of those congregated in any Washington barroom. The Chicago Tribune predicted that it would force slavery upon the free states so that Chicago might become a slave market where men, women, and children would be sold on the block. Throughout the North, anti-slavery clergymen erupted in denunciations of Taney and the majority of the court, and opposition was so fierce that the New York Herald predicted that the whole North will evidently be preached into rebellion against the highest constituted court in the country. But Lincoln, like most Illinois Republican politicians, was slow to react to the Dred Scott decision. Not until late May did he even refer to the case when, without mentioning it by name, he said the federal courts no longer exercised jurisdiction over litigation that might redound to the benefit of a nigger in some way. This seeming indifference stemmed in part from the complexity of the court's decision. The justices offered 9 separate opinions, none of which addressed exactly the same issues. 2 of them were strong dissenting opinions by anti-slavery justices John McLean and Benjamin R. Curtis. An initial examination of the opinions failed to give Lincoln much cause for alarm. As he explained later, he never complained especially of the Dred Scott decision because it held a Negro couldn't be a citizen. He agreed with Taney on this subject. Nor was he exercised because the court invalidated the Missouri Compromise. The Kansas-Nebraska Act had already expressly repealed that compromise. Lincoln was reluctant to challenge the court's ruling. He had enormous respect for the law and for the judicial process. He felt these offered a standard of rationality badly needed in a society threatened on the one side by the unreasoning populism of the Democrats, who believed that the majority was always right, and the equally unreasonable moral absolutism of reformers like the abolitionists, who appealed to a higher law than even the Constitution. As recently as the 1856 campaign, he'd invoked the judiciary as the ultimate arbiter of disputes over slavery. "The Supreme Court of the United States is the tribunal to decide such questions," he announced. And, speaking for the Republicans, he pledged, "We'll submit to its decisions, and if you, the Democrats, do also, there'll be an end of the matter." But the Dred Scott decision required him to rethink his position. If the court had decided simply that Dred Scott was a slave, He presumed no one would controvert its correctness. If this important decision had been made by the unanimous concurrence of the judges, and without any apparent partisan bias, and in accordance with legal public expectation, and with the steady practice of the departments throughout our history, he continued, it would be factious, nay, even revolutionary, not to accept it. But when a majority of the justices, overruling numerous previous judicial rulings and ignoring the extensive historical evidence that throughout American history many states had recognized blacks as citizens, which, Justice Curtis adduced in his dissent, extended their ruling to the entire African-American race, their decision was simply wrong. What troubled Lincoln most about the Dred Scott decision was the Chief Justice's gratuitous assertion that neither the Declaration of Independence nor the Constitution was ever intended to include blacks. Lincoln declared bluntly that Taney was doing obvious violence to the plain, unmistakable language of the Declaration, which had once been held sacred by all Americans and thought to include all Americans. Now, in order to make Negro slavery eternal and universal, the Declaration is assailed and sneered at and construed and hawked at and torn till, if its framers could rise from their graves, they couldn't at all recognize it. So blatant was the Chief Justice's misreading of the law, so gross was his distortion of the documents fundamental to American liberty, that Lincoln's faith in an impartial, rational judiciary was shaken. Never again did he give deference to the rulings of the Supreme Court. Lincoln kept these views to himself until June, when Douglas returned to Illinois and made a major address at Springfield defending the honest and conscientious judges who'd handed down the Dred Scott decision and denouncing criticism of the highest tribunal as a deadly blow to our whole Republican system of government. Recognizing that the Supreme Court's ruling was unpopular, Douglas seized on Taney's dictum that the Negro was not included in the Declaration of Independence as an excuse to appeal to Illinois Negrophobia. Blacks, he announced, belong to an inferior race who in all ages and in every part of the globe had shown themselves incapable of self-government. And he warned that Republicans favored the amalgamation between superior and inferior races. 2 weeks later, Lincoln offered the Republican reply to the senator. Part of his speech was a slashing attack on Douglas's popular sovereignty doctrine as a mere deceitful pretense for the benefit of slavery. He spent much time explaining the Republican position on Dred Scott. "We think the Dred Scott decision is erroneous," he declared unequivocally. "We know the court that made it has often overruled its own decisions, and we shall do what we can to have it to overrule this. We offer no resistance to it." Not until Lincoln turned to the interpretation Taney and Douglas offered of the Declaration of Independence did his words take wings. He charged that the Chief Justice and the Senator were working, together with other Democrats, to extend and to perpetuate slavery. To do so, they joined in further oppression of the already oppressed Negro. All the powers of earth seem rapidly combining against him. They have him in his prison house. They've searched his person and left no prying instrument with him. One after another, they've closed the heavy iron doors upon him, and now they have him, as it were, bolted in with a lock of 100 keys, which can never be unlocked without the concurrence of every key. The keys in the hands of 100 different men, and they scattered to 100 different and distant places, and they stand musing as to what invention, in all the dominions of mind and matter, can be produced to make the impossibility of his escape more complete than it is. And Douglas, in order to make this oppression tolerable, lugged in the absurd charge that Republicans wanted to vote and eat and sleep and marry with Negroes. He was simply trying to capitalize on that natural disgust in the minds of nearly all white people to the idea of an indiscriminate amalgamation of the white and black races. Bluntly, Lincoln rejected that counterfeit logic which concludes that because I do not want a black woman for a slave, I must necessarily want her for a wife. The authors of the Declaration of Independence never intended to say all were equal in color, size, intellect, moral developments, or social capacity. But they did consider all men created equal, equal in certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was a powerful speech, but not a radical one. Indeed, Gustav Korner, the German-American leader of the Republicans in Belleville, complained that it was too much on the old conservative order, and concluded that Lincoln was an excellent man, but no match to such impudent Jesuits and sophists as Douglas. What Lincoln omitted from his argument was as significant as what he said. Though many observers recognized that the Dred Scott decision had gutted Douglas's favorite doctrine of popular sovereignty by invalidating all congressional legislation concerning slavery in the national territories, Lincoln made no effort to point out the contradiction between the ideas of the Chief Justice and those of the senior senator from Illinois. Nor did he discuss Douglas's theory that territorial governments, despite the court's ruling in Dred Scott, could effectively exclude slavery by refusing to protect it. Lincoln's object was not to show differences between the two Democratic spokesmen, but to picture them as united in oppressing the African American and in extending the institution of slavery. That was his basic strategy for the upcoming 1858 elections, which would choose members of the state legislature that would name the next United States senator. Lincoln believed that Douglas was vulnerable, and this time he had no intention of waiting for the outcome of the elections before announcing his campaign for the Senate. As early as August 1857, he began encouraging fellow Republicans to do something now to secure the legislature, recommending that they draw up careful lists of voters by precincts. "Let all be so quiet that the adversary shall not be notified," he warned. In planning for the next Senate election, Lincoln gathered around him a group of dedicated and hard-working advisers. Some of them were familiar faces from his earlier campaigns. Herndon was, as ever, loyal if indiscreet, valuable because of his contacts among abolitionists. Both Jesse K. Dubois, the state auditor, and Ozias M. Hatch, the Secretary of State, were close political friends as well as neighbors in Springfield. Lehman and Whitney kept an eye on the north-central part of the state. In the Bloomington area, Lincoln counted on Leonard Swett and Judge Davis. In Chicago, Lincoln's strongest supporter was Norman B. Judd, who'd refused to vote for him in 1855, but had since worked closely with him in business and legal matters. Charles H. Ray of the Chicago Press and Tribune had overcome his earlier misgivings and was now one of Lincoln's most loyal backers. In southern Illinois, Joseph Gillespie, with whom he'd served in the state legislature, was his most effective supporter. It was Lincoln's special gift not merely to attract such able and dedicated advisers, and other names could readily be added to the list, but to let each of them think that he was Lincoln's closest friend and most trusted counselor. By fall, events in Kansas and in Washington made it necessary for Lincoln and his advisers to be especially alert. In the hope of ending the turmoil and bloodshed in the Kansas Territory, President Buchanan, along with many other Democrats, favored the speedy admission of Kansas as a state. And in February, the territorial government ordered an election for a constitutional convention. It was, as Lincoln remarked, the most exquisite farce ever enacted. Free soil voters, certain that the election was rigged to favor the pro-slavery faction, stayed at home. And only about 2,200 out of 9,000 registered voters participated. Nevertheless, the delegates assembled in Lecompton in September and October, drew up a constitution, and submitted it for the approval of the President and Congress. A pro-slavery document, it guaranteed not merely that the 200 or so slaves already in Kansas would remain in bondage, but that their offspring should also be slaves. The Constitution couldn't be amended for 7 years. Against the advice of both President Buchanan and Robert J. Walker, whom he'd appointed territorial governor, the convention provided for a referendum not on the Constitution itself, but only on the question of whether more slaves could be introduced into the state. Eager to have the Kansas crisis finally settled, Buchanan, ignoring his previous pledges, approved this Lecompton Constitution and recommended it to the Congress. Douglas decided to oppose it. He knew he was facing a strenuous re-election campaign in Illinois, where Lincoln almost certainly would be his opponent. He'd lost much strength by his advocacy of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and his endorsement of the Dred Scott decision, even though tepid, had cost him more. Support of the patently pro-slavery Lecompton Constitution would weaken him even further. As one of Trumbull's correspondents wrote, "If Kansas is admitted under the Lecompton Constitution, there'd not be a grease spot left to Douglas in Illinois." Aside from political considerations, Douglas felt that the document subverted his cardinal principle, popular sovereignty, because it denied the inhabitants of the Kansas Territory the right to choose their own form of government. He vowed to make the greatest effort of his life in opposition to this juggle. Breaking with President Buchanan, Douglas led the fight in the Senate against the Lecompton Constitution, denouncing it as a flagrant violation of popular rights in Kansas and an outrage on the fundamental principles of liberty upon which our institutions rest. He made it clear that his objection was to the process by which the Constitution was adopted rather than to particular provisions of that document. On the slavery referendum, he professed neutrality. "It's none of my business which way the slavery clause is decided," he told the Senate, adding a statement that Lincoln would repeatedly quote out of context, "I care not whether it's voted down or voted up." Douglas's opposition to Lecompton and to the president delighted Republicans. Horace Greeley, the influential editor of the New York Tribune, which was thought to have between 5,000 and 10,000 readers in Illinois, announced that Douglas's course was not merely right, but conspicuously, courageously, eminently so. Greeley began conferring with the senator on ways to defeat the measure, as did former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Massachusetts Republican Nathaniel P. Banks, and Benjamin F. Wade, the abolitionist senator from Ohio. Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts believed that Douglas was about to move into the Republican Party, where he would be of more weight to our cause than any other 10 men in the country. Lincoln's initial reaction to what he called the rumpus among the Democrats over Lecompton was to urge Republicans to stand clear of the quarrel, because both Buchanan and Douglas were in the wrong. He was convinced that Douglas's opposition to Lecompton was only a trick to deceive unwary Republicans. Douglas and his friends were like boys who've set a bird trap and were now watching to see if the birds are picking at the bait and likely to go under. But by late December, he began to fear that Greeley and other Eastern Republicans were walking into the trap. What does the New York Tribune mean by its constant eulogizing and admiring and magnifying of Douglas? He angrily asked Senator Trumbull. Does it, in this, speak the sentiments of the Republicans at Washington? Have they concluded that the Republican cause, generally, can be best promoted by sacrificing us here in Illinois? During the spring, Lincoln's suspicions increased as Eastern Republicans continued to praise Douglas's heroic and ultimately successful opposition to Lecompton. Further reinforcement came when Herndon, making a long-planned pleasure trip to Washington and the Northeast, reported that prominent Eastern Republicans favored Douglas's re-election and that Horace Greeley thought Illinois Republicans were fools to oppose him. Resentful of outside interference, Illinois Republicans spurned the suggestion that they ought to drop Lincoln and back Douglas for re-election. God forbid, exploded Jesse K. Dubois. Are our friends crazy? Such a shift was impossible, Herndon angrily wrote Greeley. Douglas's abuse of us as Whigs, as Republicans, as men in society, and as individuals has been so slanderous, dirty, low, long, and continuous that we cannot soon forgive and can never forget. Lincoln and his friends were also troubled by the possibility that former Democrats might defect, as they had in 1855, and back another candidate for the Senate. The most likely possibility was Long John Wentworth of Chicago, the erratic but enormously popular former Democratic congressman who'd broken with Douglas over Kansas-Nebraska and had recently been elected Republican mayor of Chicago by the largest majority ever given in that city. Wentworth probably did have vague ambitions for the senatorship, but he wisely recognized that Lincoln was the choice of most Republicans and took no steps to make himself available. But Democratic newspapers, hoping to divide their opponents, touted his candidacy, claiming that he said Lincoln could never be elected and that he intended to pack the state convention with delegates pledged to vote for him through thick and thin. Some of Lincoln's backers, notably Judd, who'd repeatedly battled Wentworth in Chicago, took the threat seriously, as did Lincoln himself. To prevent any erosion of Republican solidarity, Lincoln's friends began carefully planning for the fall elections, which would choose 87 members of the next legislature. There were 13 holdover members of the state Senate. Though Lincoln himself remained curiously passive, his supporters in county convention after county convention passed resolutions declaring that he was their first, last, and only choice for senator. Then they arranged, for only the second time in American history, to have a party state convention nominate a senatorial candidate. The procedure was so unprecedented that it attracted much attention, and a Philadelphia editor called this dangerous innovation a revolutionary effort to destroy the true intent and spirit of the Constitution. Its purpose, however, was much less grand. The nomination was designed, as Lincoln said, more for the object of closing down upon this everlasting croaking about Wentworth than anything else. Equally important, it was intended to give a clear signal to Eastern Republicans like Greeley that Illinois Republicans would never unite behind Douglas. When the Republican State Convention assembled in the State House at Springfield on June 16th, the outcome was prearranged. Without dissent, the delegates adopted a non-controversial platform Browning had drafted and nominated candidates for state treasurer and superintendent of education. Then they turned to the real business of the meeting. When Judd and the Chicago delegation brought in a banner inscribed, "Cook County is for Abraham Lincoln," the delegates exploded in applause. A member from Peoria moved to change the motto to, "Illinois is for Abraham Lincoln," and the convention went wild. Unanimously, the delegates voted that Abraham Lincoln was the first and only choice of the Republicans of Illinois for the United States Senate as the successor of Stephen A. Douglas. It was, Herndon reported, a grand affair, and the Republicans all felt like exploding, not with gas, but with electric bolts, shivering what we struck. That evening, at 8 o'clock, Lincoln gave his acceptance speech. He'd been thinking about it for several weeks, drafting sentences and paragraphs on stray pieces of paper and the backs of envelopes, storing them in his tall hat. Eventually, he wrote out the entire speech with great care, closely revising every sentence. As long as possible, he kept the contents to himself. And when Dubois asked what he was writing, Lincoln replied gruffly, "It's something you may see or hear sometime, but I'll not let you see it now." After he'd finished the final draft, he read it aloud, first to Herndon and then to a dozen or so of his other close advisers. By the evening of the convention, every word was fixed in his tenacious memory, and he had no need to refer to his manuscript when he delivered it. In conscious imitation of the opening of Daniel Webster's celebrated reply to Robert Hayne, he began, "If we could first know where we are and whither we're tending, we could then better judge what to do and how to do it. We are now far into the fifth year since a policy was initiated with the avowed object and confident promise of putting an end to slavery agitation. Under the operation of that policy, that agitation has not only not ceased, but has constantly augmented. In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis shall have been reached and passed. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It'll become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it's in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will put it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new. North as well as South."
This ends Disc 11.